Hello and welcome to the Collegiate Empowerment Show. This is your host, Tony D'Angelo. Thanks for joining me for episode number 88 of the Collegiate Empowerment Show. We've got another great interview format of today's program. We're going to be interviewing a rock star. It's Paul Brown. Now, if you don't know who Paul Brown is and you're in higher education and you even have a computer, let alone if you're any form of social media, you've got to know who this guy is. If you don't know him, you know his work. You've seen his blog posts. You've seen his graphic images. You've seen his infographics. You've seen his Lego and student affairs professionals memes. The guy is a creative genius. And I, like you, made my first acquaintance with Paul online. Actually, I've been following his work through his blog at paulgordonbrown.com, as well as his posts on different media formats, including Twitter and Facebook and all those great spaces. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul to introduce you to him. But he's a scholar, a consultant, a speaker, and he specializes in student learning and development intersecting between technology, social media, and design. And as I love, Paul is all about, like some of our other guests, Paul's not a sermon you're going to hear. He's not a talking head. He's somebody, if you just watch his work, you watch his output, he's a sermon that you see. Now, in addition to all these great things, he's totally a coffee junkie. He's a foodie. He's a traveler, a thrill seeker. He's had over 15 years of professional experience in higher ed and student affairs in so many different functional areas. He's also served as an instructor at Boston College, Merrimack College, and their higher ed programs. Now, most recently, he served as the acting vice president and dean of student affairs at FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. Again, what a great combination between his student affairs work, the technology, and of course, design. Now, in addition to that work that he does in higher ed, he's also an independent speaker and consultant, and he shared his messaging with all kinds of audiences, both nationally, internationally, from Anchorage, Alaska to Dubai. I mean, talk about a track record. Now, another way you can get your hands on some of Paul's work is go to LinkedIn, go into SlideShare, and you'll see that in 2014, he was recognized as a keynote author for his excellent presentations, delivery, and design. Love, love his work. Now, he's also a published author. His latest work he did in collaboration with Eric Qualam is a contributing author to What Happens on Campus Stays on YouTube, is another great book you want to add to your shelf. So we're going to talk about his work. We're going to talk about his book. We're going to talk about digital identity in higher education. Just some really fantastic stuff. So if you're like me and you're not as tech savvy, by certain you want to get Paul Brown's thinking in your space and also in your campus culture and community. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of the Collegiate Empowerment Show as we join Paul Gordon Brown. Be well until then. Hello and welcome to the Collegiate Empowerment Show. This is your host, Tony D'Angelo, and live on the line with me today is Paul Brown. Paul, welcome to the Collegiate Empowerment Show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks. I'm so glad to be here with you guys today.
Yes, so I'm super stoked because I got to tell you, Paul. Now, the listeners will learn about you and have learned about you in the introduction, so that we're going to do that in the post-production. But in the meantime, I haven't told you this, but I got to tell you, you're probably one of the, probably to date, the most intelligent and brightest person we've had on the Collegiate Empowerment Show. So I think that speaks volumes to you, not to our previous guests. So no knock to the previous guests, but you're doing some really cutting edge, just amazing stuff out there in the world in the space of digital identity and how it relates in higher ed. So we got to know, how the hell did you get here? How did you get started with this stuff?
Yeah, wow, that's high praise. I hope I can live up to it today. For me, you know, when I grew up, I grew up in Rochester, New York, in the shadow of Eastman Kodak Company, and my father worked for Eastman Kodak Company. He was one of those career people that, you know, started working for a company at a young age, stayed with it all the way through, stuff that you really don't hear about nowadays, and he would always experiment with technology, and that's when I started to develop a passion for it, because I grew up around it. And then it was when I started my PhD work, so my research, really within the last 5-6 years that I thought, well, what topic am I going to do? What should I focus on? And that's where I thought, well, maybe I could marry my passion for higher ed with my passion for technology and do something in that space. And so that's really kind of kick-started what I've been doing for the past, 5-6 years now, really in earnest, which is looking at social media, digital technology, and how is that impacting college students? And there's a lot of different angles you can take on that. And so that's what's really kind of kicked me off and started me in this kind of sphere.
Yeah, and you've no doubt by far in that past 5-6 years just to have become one of the leading thinkers, scholars in this area. So it's just so exciting to have you on the show here. So I'm on your website right now, and there's this adorable picture. I mean, you got to go to his website. It's paulgordonbrown.com of you in front of a computer. And am I making this out right? Is that an Atari 800 that you've got working?
You are exactly right. Like, it's actually an Atari 800 XL, but you got that right down to the number. That's amazing.
That was my first computer as well, and it looks like you're loading states and capitals into the cassette player, if I'm looking at this correctly.
Yeah, it had the cassette player attachment. Talk about old school.
I mean, it is. It's fascinating. So I love this hybrid of student affairs, but now bringing the technology. But I think there's a really cool element here, because I was just actually, ironically enough, reading the story of Eastman Kodak this morning. And I want to talk to you a little bit. But before we do that, I want to go there with you about what that was like being in that area, your father working for that company, the whole idea of lifetime employment, you know, for this big company forever. And for a moment, but let's rewind a second. So you grew up in Rochester. Take us through you undergrad to grad and where you are today. Tell us about some of that schooling experience.
Sure thing. So my undergraduate experience, you know, right after finishing high school, I went on to SUNY Geneseo, so State University of New York College of Geneseo, which is actually local here to Rochester, considered one of the honors colleges, the SUNY system, and loved it. It was a public liberal arts college, of which there are not too many public liberal arts colleges out there, many private ones, but not public. But it really fit that mission and really had a lot of meaning. I was a philosophy major, loved it. still think like a philosopher to this day. Before going straight on to graduate school at Western Illinois. So I did my degree there in college student personnel, so really in higher education when I was at Western.
All right, so you go from philosophy to student affairs. How? Okay, something happens in your undergraduate days. I mean, I think you were there. Was Tom Matthews still there when you were there?
Yes, in fact, Tom Matthews, who's known in a lot of the leadership circles because he does a lot with leadership development and programs, was just starting his program there at Geneseo. And so actually I did an independent study with him on leadership my senior year in college.
Oh, my goodness. So you're like one of the original gold members. Isn't that it's the gold leadership program, right? Isn't that what it's called?
That is exactly it. And it started right around that time that I was there. It had originally actually just been a leadership program that did workshops, just a one-off, didn't really have much developed around it, that the student union did, and actually we in student government, because I was on student government at the time, funded that, and Tom said, I want to take this to the next level, and so we said, okay, so we put more funding towards it. He developed some mentor relationships. There was a new vice president that came in, and that program has since just exploded. I mean, it's even when I go to other places now, I still go back to that as a model that people can look at, and he's done amazing things with it since I graduated.
Oh, that's so cool. So I do hope, Tom, if you're listening to this show, look at that. Look at the byproducts of your success. That's awesome. That's so cool. So you go to get your degree in philosophy, but it sounds like you got your education in student life and student development. You said student government. What other things? I mean, were you an RA? Were you an orientation leader?
I was everything. That's in part what kind of made me move towards student affairs. So I was an orientation leader. I was in student government. I was on the faculty senate, in student organizations. I was in the residence hall association president. RA. The one thing I didn't do in college that I always wished I had done was student activities. And so when I went on for my graduate degree, that's actually what my assistantship was in, was student activities, because that was the one area I didn't have experience in as an undergrad that I wanted to get.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so now give me the years to tie in with this, because I want to see what's happening in the world outside of higher ed as it relates to technology and evolution. So you're at the SUNY system, what year you graduate, and then you go to Illinois. Tell us a little about those dates there.
Yeah, sure. Easy to remember, because I think almost everything in my life goes in 2 to 4 year increments. So, mm-hmm. So graduated college in 2000, and then went on to my graduate degree right away, and so graduated with that 2002. So right around the time, really, of the internet's ascendance, right? So I did have the best personal webpage in college, which was pretty basic if you look at it today, but I was pretty proud of that at the time. And that's when the internet was really starting to take off. I mean, my first year in college when I was a freshman, so it would have been 1996, was the first year they had wired Ethernet access for internet in the residence hall. So I started right at the right time for that internet.
Mm. And it really is. I think anybody who has been in college before 2000 is at a complete disadvantage, because you've been able, I mean, you were literally born and raised on this new model of education. And so many of us, myself included, didn't have that opportunity. So the whole idea that the world is still so young and new and fresh and a different way to look at it, a huge part because of technology now. It sounds like you were one of the very first people out there to actually start to not only ride the wave, but actually begin to create it and move it forward. That's great stuff. So how does this, with your technology background, dad from Kodak at Eastman Kodak, tell us how this all merges? Because I get the student affairs side, but the technology and your wizardry in that area, talk more about that. How does Paul's brain work, you know?
That's a good question. You know, I had always been into graphic design and doing things related to graphic design. So even in high school, I worked on some of the publications, the student newspaper, things of that sort. And at the time, I was really doing some things that people weren't doing yet, because now a lot of our publishing tools, things that we do with graphic design, are pretty commonplace. And so the kind of barrier for entry for folks is a lot lower than it once was, but at that time it was actually fairly high. And so I would just use those tools to accomplish things, but never really thought, maybe I could wed this in with an academic interest, right? I just did it. I didn't necessarily didn't think to study it. And so that's why I'd always use those tools. People, I kind of became the informal tech support in the office when I was, you know, in my first job. So anyone has a computer problem, they'd come to me. So rather than going to the actual campus department. And so it was after doing that for so long that I go, well, gosh, I need to come up with something to research. If you're going to do a PhD, you have to figure that out. And I said, well, then maybe this should be it. And social media actually wasn't even necessarily the focus of my technology use at the time, but that's kind of what's the most interesting thing, I think, in tech right now is social media and that type of technology and sharing. And so it's really when I started a PhD, which is about almost 5 years ago now, that's when I said, I better get on this. I better figure this out. And in order to do that, I have to experiment with it. And so with that then came my website and blogging and doing all these things, because really, if you're studying it, you have to get your hands dirty to understand how it works. And if you just read about it, that's one thing, but you really have to experiment with it. Try this thing, what happens? Try this thing, what happens? To get a good deep feel of it. And so that's when it really ramped up, at least the social media aspect of it, was within the past few years. The design and all the rest of that kind of had predated that time.
That's awesome. You know, just to your credit, and I'm going to be frank with you on this and for the listeners out there, you know, Paul, since you were very generous, you said, oh, you got to get your hands dirty, okay? And hey, if you follow anything that Paul's done or designed, they're not dirty. They're blistered. They're cut. They're torn. They're worn. I mean, this man has typed and blogged and posted and I think experimented more than anybody. I mean, honestly, quite frankly, you should be teaching the course, let alone, you know, trying to qualify for the course, because I think you are, you know, you're actually one of those pioneers in social media, particularly as it relates to higher ed. So let's talk a little bit about the PhD. Where are you enrolled? How did this all come to be? Because I mean, social media wasn't even a word until about 2008. I mean, you're more the historian, so tell me a little bit about that. But then talk about the program you're involved in and what you're focusing on right now.
Yeah. I'm a full-time PhD student at Boston College. So I'm actually wrapping up now. So I'm finishing off the dissertation. I'm writing the end of it and should hopefully finish beginning of spring. The more I keep saying that, the more I feel like I hold myself to it. So now that it's out there publicly, I know I have to finish early.
Yes,
spring.
And the show will air in November 16th. So just to be aware, if we're checking in on you, Paul.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. I got it. You got to do it. If anyone's gone through this process before, they know how that is. So, when I started, so I would have started my degree in 2011. It's even a very different landscape than it is now. So, if you were to even look at my dissertation, I just finished kind of revising the first first portion of it, which includes a lit review, and you know, you say what's out there in terms of the literature. I had to go back and really revise that in the past couple months, because when I started writing it, it was up to date. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm writing it now, there's been a whole bunch of research that's gone out and literature that's out there that I needed to incorporate into my literature review to keep it up to date, because it moves so quickly. That's one of the biggest difficulties in researching social media and digital technology, is it moves fast. So by the time you write something and publish something, it can already be out of date. So it's really hard. It's like researching a moving target. So, so things have changed drastically since then, and really my focus ended up being, as I went through more and more, is how is social media, how is this technology that we're using and interacting with other people on, how is that impacting who do we think we are, our sense of self, our sense of identity, and how that identity develops or forms? Is that really looking different? And that became the crux of my research, is how is technology impacting? I look at student development, but really it's human development, right? It could be college students, it could be anyone, but I'm just happen to be looking at college students as a subpopulation. And there's just some really interesting things going on in that space that other researchers have maybe hinted at. You know, Dana Boyd did this great book on teenagers that's called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. And I'm doing something very similar, but with a college student, traditional age college student audience. And I'm finding a lot of similarities, and I'm also finding some things that are a little bit different. So it's been a fun ride. And whenever people hear what I talk about, they always say, tell me more. I want to know more about that. So people are passionate about it. They're thinking about it. They know there's something interesting going on
there. And I'm one of those people. That's why I want you on this show. So go deeper. Do you mind sharing what you're learning in some of your research as it relates to this construct that you've been talking about digital identity and what that all means? I mean, I'm familiar with your work with some of the listeners may or may not be. So kind of just give us the 40,000 foot overview, and then just tell us some of those unique distinctions you've seen in this work that you're doing, this research you're doing. Do you mind sharing?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I think the first thing, and this is usually what whenever I present on it or talk about it, there's one thing I usually make a distinction with first, is the term digital identity, used a lot of different places, especially if you go into any student affairs conferences and those circles. This term digital identity or digital identity development is used in a lot of different ways. And there's actually two concepts really going on in there that people tend to conflate and mash up together. And the one is you have a digital reputation. So that's what you put out online. When people Google you, that's what they find. When people look up your social media accounts, that's the information that's kind of been put out there for you. Eric Qualman calls it your digital stamp, maybe your digital footprints. It's really the information, the data. And so a lot of people talk about digital identity as that, meaning how do you influence how other people see you? How do you make sure that when you're applying to a college, an admissions officer doesn't see a picture maybe you don't want them to see, or a potential employer doesn't find something that you don't want them to find? And so that's really digital reputation, digital identity development in that sense talks about those concepts. But what people often do is they hear that term identity and they think of, for higher ed folks, they think, oh, I've heard that term before, identity development, and kind of the psychological process of how people form identities, be it, you know, their African-American identity, their LGBT identity, different aspects of that. And that's very different from your reputation. Your reputation is one thing and might be influenced by your development as a person, but your development as a person and that identity is a very different way of talking about digital identity. And that's, I focus on both, but my research is really focused in on the second part. What is it doing in terms of how we understand ourselves and how we change over time? And that's probably the most interesting thing to me. I do find, though, when I speak across the country here and there, that when I speak to student audiences, I'm talking about the first one, the reputation, the rules. What does that mean? What should I think about? It's guided by the work that I do with development, but that's kind of what the students need. And then when I talk to the educators, I'm talking about the second part. What's going on with the development of these students that you're talking to, and what do you need to teach them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really I would love to hear your point on this, because this is, I've noticed this, you know, in my own life, being, you know, I'm a tech, not that I'm tech phobic. I mean, I did have an Atari 800, right? But but I'm not as tech savvy as I'd like to be. So I kind of constantly want to learn how to evolve and be aware of that. And one of the things I'm noticing in my own life, and tell me if this is true, you see in the research, like when I'm on Facebook, and I've been on Facebook since 2008, okay? So I'm not like an early adopter, but it, you know, wasn't 2014 when I finally got on. And the one thing I have come to understand about technology, any type of technology, any type of tool, it really just amplifies who we are. You know, I always like to say Facebook is like alcohol or like money. You know, if you give a nice guy a couple beers, they become a really nice guy and they sometimes can get a little annoying. If you give a greedy person a lot of money, they become even more greedy. Or if you give a generous person more money, they become even more generous. I think the same is true with technology, that it amplifies our kind of our behavior or who we are. First, is that a true sentiment from your point as a researcher and as a scholar? Is that accurate, or am I off there a little bit? You know, you're the expert, I'm not, but.
No, you're actually spot on. And in fact, you know, one of the things, I'm doing interviews with students, that's how I'm collecting my data. I do a series of interviews with them, fairly in depth. And a word that had come up in those interviews is amplified. And one thing that I found as a consistent theme is amplified. And what's, I think, most interesting as I'm digging into it right now, and what I've been thinking about most, is this idea of what you put out there about yourself on social media. All my students talk about, and I think this is true of my own experience, and you'll probably say it's true of yours as well, we put out the positive, right? Anytime there's a success or a family, something happy happening with your family, that's usually what you post. You generally do not post negative things that go on in your life, or the mundane, the boring, right? And so what happens is, when you start only posting these positive kind of hyper reality type posts, you know, here's me on the Grand Canyon, or here's me eating this insanely fatty food, it creates this impression in people's minds that your life is maybe a little bit different than it is. And I can give you an example. So I have a friend who I don't see that often. He actually works in Dubai, so I really don't see him that often. But he'll see all these posts I put up on social media. And I'm a big-time foodie, so I like to find the really unique and decadent foods, you know, the cronuts and all those kinds of things, and post those. And so I will post those to social media fairly regularly because I eat a lot. And he said to me, like, how is it that you stay the size that you are, because I'm fairly trim, and eat all this food? And I said, well, that's because when I eat a salad every day, I don't post a picture of that. You're only seeing a snapshot of my life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that I'm eating all this fatty food all the time. You're just not seeing the stuff that happens in between. And social media is always just a snapshot. And so it has this tendency to amplify your life like that. And sometimes people get drawn into that of then wanting to amplify their life even more. You know, there's an article about the number of deaths related to selfies in the United States is larger than the number of deaths from shark attacks. Yeah, that went around just recently, and that's because people take selfies, like, in front of the Grand Canyon, and oops, I stepped backwards and I fell over, or, you know, things that are extreme sports or extreme situations where they want to get that picture, because that shows how amazing their life is, and really amplifies on social media how great their life is and the things that they're doing. And so that statistic doesn't really surprise me, in that, you know, we're trying to take pictures of our experience and have lived this kind of amplified life. It's interesting, because there was another article related to talking, something actually similar was, whereas before we used to see status in what we bought or what we wore. So you buy a very expensive outfit or you have a really expensive car, and that indicated status. This one article, this opinion article, was saying now the currency has become the experience.
Yes.
Rather than buying the car, I'm going to show you, look, here I'm bungee jumping off of a building in the United Arab Emirates, or I'm doing this crazy thing, that actually has more currency in this culture, because you can take a picture and post that on social media and it'll get more of an amplified effect than that great outfit that you happen to wear.
I think that, I mean, that's, wow, that's a great distinction there about what's evolving in, you know, as you're saying, the currency or the economics of the 21st century. That's a really Good insight. Thanks for sharing that point of view. You know, let me go back a little bit what you said about then part two. You said the digital reputation is part one, but then this these ourselves over time. And that was the other thread that I was remembering about myself is that, so in 2008, I get involved, and now every now and then I get these flashback pictures of myself or some smart ass comment that I made to somebody who was, you know, like my buddy on Facebook. And I'm like, oh shit, this is out for the whole world now. What did I do? And so, because I do put my foot in my mouth a lot. So that's very amplified in my way of being. So talk to us, what's happening in my, not that you're a psychologist here, but I'm going to sit on the couch with you here and tell me, what's that going to do to me? What do you think? What are you seeing in your research as you consult and speak to professionals about this digital identity over time? Because I'm not who I was in 2000. I don't hang out with the same people. I don't have the same partnership, you know, but I'm constantly reminded of that more now than I think any other generation. So talk to that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I ask my research participants in part, I'm looking at primarily third and fourth year students, so seniors, juniors, people that are getting ready to graduate. And so one of the questions that I ask them is, reflect back on how you use social media when you were in high school or even as a freshman coming into college. How do you think your social media use has changed over time? And a number of them, this was pretty consistent, would say, oh my gosh, if I look back on those posts that I put out there 4 years ago, I'd look at it and think, why did I post that? Why did I think that was cool? Why would I do that? And in fact, a number of my participants also had younger siblings or cousins or family members who are in high school who post things because they want to get a lot of likes. That's a whole other topic in itself. They see it as kind of a weird behavior. They understand it, and they say, so I just go along with it. You know, I liked my sister's photo because I knew that would make her happy. But they're just in a very different place in terms of the way they use technology now, and it very much follows what we know about how humans change over time. So if you look at younger folks who are usually driven by external motivations, what do other people think about me, they're going to post things and put out pictures and hope it gets a lot of engagement, a lot of likes, a lot of comments, because then they think that means something about them. And then by the time they get older, when they're more internally defined, yeah, it's nice to get that engagement from other people, but I'm posting this more for myself and more for sharing it with people, not fishing for validation through others. And so that really changes over time. And part of that is, too, like when you mentioned the digital reputation aspect, one of the things I say to my students that I speak with is I feel very lucky that I grew up during a time where all the mistakes I made throughout my high school, teenage, and college years are not posted on the internet and will follow me for the rest of my life, right? I didn't grow up like they are, where it's constant and always on, and they're having to navigate through that. And I think part of that is being smart about what you're putting out there. So that's what I try to teach them. But also, too, I think there's going to be a societal change that, you know, we understand over time that these things will happen. And since we're all in the same boat, meaning we could all dig up dirt on each other, people will care a lot less about that. And I think we've even seen that over time now, like, you know, Barack Obama admitting to smoking marijuana when he was growing up and things like that, versus if you look at politicians that admitted that 20, 30 years ago, there was a very different societal reaction to than the one that we have today, which is basically just to kind of shrug it off. So I think our society will be more understanding of youthful indiscretions, so to speak, over time, because we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, I think it's so, what a treasure trove of fascination as in all these areas of not only our external life, of how we look at each other, but then our own internal world. I mean, never before to have this, just this digital archive of our lives is just so fascinating. And going back and just assessing, where was I at that point? And I found a lot of self-forgiveness has been helpful for me as I look back at my own profiles. Oh, wow, I was really angry at that point in my life. Or, boy, I was frustrated about that. But also, you know, having that blessing, I have a son, and remembering those days that, you know, that we took off school and went to go watch the Lego movie. You know, I remember that day. And the digital the platforms allow me to kind of reconnect with that. So this is fantastic. So tell us more about, you know, where do you think, let's go a little bit, you're in the present, looking at the past with your, and by the way, next time you come on the show, I'm calling you doctor, okay, right? Is that right?
I'm in.
All right, so we're now in the future, Doc, here, and I want to know more about where do you think the future is heading with some of this technology, and specifically how, as we as institutions of higher education, how we as professionals in the industry can utilize and leverage these tools. What are some of the things you're seeing out there in the space as it projects out into the future?
Yeah. Wow, there's kind of two things going on there. I think in terms of the future and the way that students interact with technology and the way we go forward is that technology is going to be more intimate than it ever was before, right? So one of the more exotic examples I give is of cyborgs, right? So you think of famous cyborgs from science fiction. You think of Inspector Gadget. You think of RoboCop. You think of all these kind of half-human, half-machine hybrids. And if you look at the way our technology is evolving, right, we have Google Glass that you wear on your eyes. You've got the Apple Watch that you'd have on your arm. We're wearing our technology now. We're not just carrying it. And then we can also start to integrate it with it. So if you even look online and you look at human cyborgs, you actually see where people are getting implants and things of that sort, which is still pretty far off, still pretty exotic. But you can tell that we're increasingly moving in this direction where technology is very intimate with who we are. Always on, always connected is one of the phrases that you'll hear pretty consistently. And so I think that changes because if we talk about our theories as being based on human beings and we have a lot of technology integrated with us, we might not be the same human beings we were before. And so I think our students will continue to push that envelope year after year, and we'll still have to reevaluate all these different concepts as we go. So I think that's really where it's coming to. I call it digitization, right? So the more digitized you are. And some of our students today live a large portion of their lives online, so they're almost living, you know, as if they're machines themselves in some ways, and some not at all. There's always kind of a range, but I think the more we continue to go, the more we'll be integrated with that technology. And I think when it comes to institutions then and our engagement with students, a lot of institutions are now really starting to get social media as a phenomenon and do interesting things. So before, when higher education institutions approached social media, it was, great, we have a replacement for the flyer. Which it can be used that way, but if you use it even deeper, you can start to build relationships with your students online. I know that, you know, I go to Boston College, and they're pretty active on social media. I know if I post a picture on campus that, in all likelihood, Boston College alumni social media accounts are going to comment on it or like it or interact with it somehow. Probably the BC athletics department's going to comment or interact with it somehow, and probably the BC main account is. And so every time I get that kind of interaction with Boston College, I feel like someone's listening. I feel closer to that institution. And it's an interesting phenomenon where I can create connections with an institution and a sense of community just through these online interactions. And I think the more colleges and universities can focus on that, in addition to sharing information and deadlines and events and things like that, but create relationships online, that's where really the power to unlock some really impressive and interesting things happens. Could impact retention, could impact all sorts of indicators that we care about. So that's where I think we're going in the future in terms of higher education professionals interacting on social media, is developing more relationship type engagements.
Love it. You said two critical words are one for the institution, more relationships, and for the individuals, more intimacy, particularly when it comes to those wearables. That's good stuff. So do you have examples, or are you aware of, or have you been to, like, who's doing it really right? Like, what have you seen that's, wow, this is the way to use the tool with where it's at right now? What names, name schools, name people. What are you seeing that's working?
Sure thing. You know, I did mention Boston College. Part of the reason why I even went there to study in the first place was because they were doing a lot of great things with social media. They have a social media council that meets on a monthly basis, and that council actually already has its own blog where they share what they're doing and their strategies and the experimentation. So they're doing some really great stuff. University of Houston does some really interesting engagements. They're pretty active. Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts, which Ed Cabell Bellin. If folks work with technology, they probably know Ed's name, because Ed and I do a lot together because he researches in the same area. He actually had a brand new position created, more or less just for him, to kind of bring together all the social media accounts in Student Life and start producing content and engaging with students. So if you went to bsulife.com for Bridgewater State University Life, so bsulife.com, they have some really interesting ways that they're engaging with students and putting content out there doing things.
Yeah, Ed, I'm a huge... I'm sorry, I just got to do have to give a Jules shout-out to Ed Cabellan. Ed is a longtime fan, friend of Collegiate Empowerment. I remember his early days when he started dabbling in this thing called social media, and just what a class act. He's going to be a guest on the show in the future, too. So, Ed, if you're listening, look forward to having you on as well. But thanks for making that little plug for Ed, Paul. I appreciate it. So keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to get that out as well.
Yeah. Actually, I'm also going down to University of Delaware next week. I'm speaking with the students and with the staff there. And I will tell you, they contacted me to come speak, but then they also wanted me to help them a little bit with their departmental presence or divisional presence. And they produced a document. They had a committee get together. Let's analyze where we are, where we think we should go. And they put together a document for it. And I can tell you, when I looked at it, I was the happiest person you could ever find. Because really, compared to what I saw coming out of them and what I've seen from institutions even just 2, 3, 4 years ago, the sophistication level, I think, in higher education is really starting to reach critical mass. Mm. That they're doing some really great stuff. They understood it. They got it. They knew which places to look. And so those folks at Delaware, if that's true of the other institutions, and I'm starting to see it more and more, is I think we're starting to finally wrap our heads around how can we use this in a very meaningful way. So it's really an exciting time.
It certainly is. Now, outside of higher ed, I know that I'm a little stalker, and I follow you all the time, and I know you are a big, you have a certain airline that you have a personal affinity to, I would say love affair, but... you know, this is live on the show, so I won't go in deep to it. But, you know, tell us the airline you're in love with. Come on. We all know. Just bring it out.
Yeah. My stories with JetBlue, my fun travel stories with JetBlue.
They're awesome. So JetBlue, are they doing it right? I mean, to me they are, but you're the guru. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So my story with JetBlue is I obviously travel a lot, speak at different college and universities, and I even went through a period during my PhD where I realized, wait a minute, I have a lot of time, flexible time. You know, I can do work from almost anywhere. It's mobile now. Why don't I travel and visit some friends and stay with them and see the country a little bit? And so I started flying JetBlue a lot because I was in Boston, and they're in part based in Boston. And so it was through this kind of Twitter love fest that we developed that they're like my invisible travel companion that will tweet back and forth. Funny jokes, try to surprise people. They delivered Starbucks to me on the plane once. I mean, you name it. There's great stories that come from that. Mm. But the other thing is JetBlue was one of the first companies to really get it right, certainly the first airline. And if you look at the change in airline social media presence, it's followed the JetBlue model over time. So they do some really, really cool stuff in terms of content and in terms of being engaging. They speak in real-life terms. They don't sound like form letters when they talk to you. And it's been a really fun ride to kind of play around with them as I travel, but then also learn from them and learn what they're doing right.
Mm. That's fantastic. It sounds like, you know, just because the technology there doesn't necessarily replace the core genius of human beings. And those great creative storytellers, I think this is prime platform, prime time for you great storytellers out there to be able to share your story. I mean, would you agree with that, Paul?
Yeah, that is what it's about. Doing social media well is about being able to tell stories well. It's about engaging with people. It's about being humble. It's about being authentic. If you can get kind of those more, I wouldn't necessarily call them intangibles, but they're not the, you know, tools and the nitty-gritty of the technology, that stuff can come with you. But if you don't have kind of those intangible things going into it or that mindset, you're never going to be successful.
All right, so say those.
You can read all the manuals and do that, doesn't matter.
Say those again. I need humility. What else do I need?
Authenticity.
What else?
Genuineness is usually the term I like to use.
Okay.
Ability to tell a story. If you can be funny, that certainly doesn't hurt either. I don't know that you have to be, but if you can be funny and engaging and responsive, You can be responsive to people. You know, if someone messages me, I almost always try to reach out. There's times when I can't, but I always try to at least give out some form of acknowledgement.
Good stuff. Well, that's so helpful. Thank you for that. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, any other insights about the future, where you see this going before we go to the next section of the show.
Sure. The one thing I think we're going to need to grapple with is kind of the social effects of technology. And there's one thing in particular that I think of, and one thing I consistently found with the students, which is how seeing this idolized or amplified, as we talked about, presence of other people impacts your psyche and how you navigate that. So for a lot of students, seeing all these people having wonderful times on social media necessarily means that you start to compare yourself to them. Am I having as great of experience as this person? And you also see that with some of the behaviors that happen online. I had a student who was saying, I posted a picture, and after 15 minutes, it didn't get that many likes, and so I took it down. Like, I didn't leave it up. And the student said, I don't know why I did that. I mean, it doesn't really matter, right? But I took it down, and I thought it was weird after the fact. That's not an uncommon behavior to find online, especially amongst teenagers, is this, put it up, if it doesn't get enough likes, take it down. And so there's this kind of weird perversion of your sense of self-worth, and what does that mean, and how do I compare to others, and, you know, am I having as great a time as them, or are they ahead of me? That social media tends to have that amplified effect that impacts our psyche, and I think that's something that's increasingly going to be more and more what we need to tackle, is how do we help people through that.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. Some of our facilitators at Collegiate Empowerment, when they're out in the field, we have a program that we do called Focus on Progress, Not Perfection. And the idea of perfection is that there's this ideal. And never before has a generation been so bombarded with all these ideals, like you said, these peak moment images on Instagram, that you've got to compare your life to not just yourself, but now your entire peer group. And, you know, you've got a friend in France and a friend in the Grand Canyon and a friend like standing on the edge of Niagara Falls. I mean, and you're like, I'm at home in, central Iowa and, life sucks. That can be overwhelming, right? We've seen that happen.
Exactly, yeah. You see all those images and it influences your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have to get an Instagram account because I have a very non-glamorous life, and I think it would help boost people's self-esteem. That could show. Here I am sitting. Well,
there's a joke about Martha Stewart is on Instagram, and she posts food pictures, and she posts really bad food pictures, like unappetizing, like bad lighting and not a good angle. And so there was this big to-do on the internet of, like, let's look at Martha Stewart's food pictures because they're so unexciting and unappealing, So, yeah, there's definitely, you have a niche on there.
That's good. I appreciate that, and I look for you for more advisement as well. So, good stuff. So, let's look at higher ed as a whole. Now, you have this great background of student affairs, and now with this technology, the social media, all that's happening in this amazing space. Paul, what do you think? I want to hit the question threefold. In American higher ed today, what are we doing right? What's missing? And what do we need to be doing differently? And you got 3 minutes to answer that question. I'm joking, but no, take as much time. But just hit any of those. What are your thoughts? I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I think we're getting better at helping students make meaning of their experience. So really reflecting on it and understanding what that is, I think we've made some good strides in that area. You look at any functional area, so you look at, let's say, service learning. The fact that we used to do community service, and then we talked about service learning, which means you more reflect on what are the issues going on. You're not just going and serving a community and leaving, but now you reflect on those issues. And then even it kind of evolved into the term community-based learning. Meaning we're not just going there to serve other people, but we're working alongside them to help better the community. And so I think that kind of meaning-making that we've made progress on has really helped transform the college experience for students. I think the reverse of that, in terms of what we're missing, is those often privilege students that are on our campuses in a residential setting that are probably 18 to 24 years old. And as we know, that is not a majority of college students in the United States. Many are adult learners. Many will go to community college, not live on campus. And so I think we've really done a poor job of figuring out how can we take those meaning-making, transformative experiences that we work with residential students on and translate it for commuting and adult learner populations. And that's what I think we need to do differently then to kind of transition into the third one is figure out ways to change the educational process so that it fits the diversity of who it is that we have as students. You know, there's a lot of cool things, especially with technology going on, where people are experimenting with breaking up degrees, right? You don't have to stay for 4 years to get a degree, but maybe we could do smaller certificate programs, or some people use badges, like as in games, you make an achievement, you get a badge. There's badging for certifying different like learning skills. And so how can we break apart some of those educational experiences so that they're more flexible and people are getting different skill sets in a way that suits them and the method of delivery that works for them? So maybe that might be online for some. Maybe some people aren't suited well for online learning, so they do need to be in a classroom. Maybe it's a blend of the two. And offering just a more diverse kind of array of educational experiences. And that's what I think was most exciting and also something we're still working through is what does that look like in the future? You know, what do our higher education institutions do as more and more goes online?
Mm. Great stuff. Thank you. Thank you so much. And there's so much for us to talk about. First, you're coming back as a guest in a future show. Yes or yes?
Yes.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. So there's no alternative. And because I want to definitely talk about being a Kodak kid, what that was like. I want to talk, there's some other cool stuff in technology that I want to hear your point of view on. But we have hit the magic moment in the Collegiate Empowerment Show, which we go through the lightning round, which I'm going to ask you a series of random, weird, and sometimes inappropriate questions. Are you ready, Paul Brown, to be in the lightning round? All right.
Ready as I will ever be.
So, favorite, this is going to be easy. I'm going to throw you the biggest, juiciest meatball right up. Favorite airline?
JetBlue, that's easy.
Okay, good. All right. Top three favorite books.
Three favorite books. I loved Lord of the Rings as I was growing up as a kid. Love that. Right now, I will put Dana Boyd in there, the book that I mentioned earlier. It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens, because that's really helping me with my research. And then I'm going to put in my own plug, which is the book that I collaborated with Eric Coleman on, which is What Happens on Campus Stays on YouTube.
Good stuff. That is awesome. Let's keep that book thread going here. What one book have you gifted or given away the most and why?
That's an easy one. It's called Flatland, and it was made about a century ago. And what it does is it tells the story of a square and his adventures through Lineland and Pointland and Flatland. And it's kind of an allegory for looking at things from different perspectives. And I always give that to people as a kind of going away gift.
Very cool. Thank you. Your three favorite movies?
Clue, the movie Clue, based on the board game. That's number one for sure. Other movies. I will take any of the Lord of the Rings trilogy because I just watched that.
All right. Whoa. Let's go deep. No, I need to know which of the three then is your favorite?
Clue, by far.
Number two.
Campy, it's funny.
No, not of the movies. I'm sorry. Lord of the Rings, the series. Which of the series is your favorite one?
Oh, great question. I'm going to go with the second one. It's the meaty one. It's the one that's got the most action.
I agree. Keep going. This is about you, not me. Keep going. What's number three movie?
Number three movie? I'll go with what I was just watching. The classic. I was watching Back to the Future because yesterday was Back to the Future Day. So.
You got it. There you go. Good stuff. All right. If I say the word huggable, what or who comes to mind?
The bear that does the commercials for fabric softener, Snuggle.
Oh, that is awesome. Good stuff. All right, if I say punchable, what comes to mind? Don't say the bear from the Snuggle Bear. Punchable. Who or what would you want to punch?
So principal?
No, punchable. Like, I'm going to punch. Yeah, I'm going to punch them.
Punchable. Oh, that's good, because I was going to give a completely different answer. That's a different answer. Punchable, let's not make it too political, but I'm not a huge Donald Trump fan.
Okay, great. He's going to be on a guest on the show next week. No, I'm just joking. All right, so if I grabbed your phone from you and I looked at your home screen and I saw your top three most used apps, what would they be, Paul?
Top top three would be Facebook, followed by Twitter, followed by Instagram.
Nice. What new app are you really playing around with or you're curious about?
Yeah, I love the app Nuzzle, N-U-Z-Z-E-L. And what it does is it takes all the articles that people share across all your social networks and gives you a digest every day of the top five most shared articles from your social media accounts.
And that's Nuzzle, N-U-Z-Z-E-L?
Yep,
oh,
got it.
Oh, sweet. Thank you. Good stuff. See, I love this. What did you have for breakfast today, Paul?
A toasted graham latte from Starbucks.
Nice. And you're a Starbucks fan. Am I correct about this?
You are. Coffee any of any form from anywhere.
How many cups of coffee do you drink a day on average?
On average, we'll go with shots of espresso and or cups of coffee, and that would probably be 3 to 4.
Cool. And how do you take it? How do you drink it? Do you take cream and sugar? Do you like it black? How do you like it?
Black.
Nice. Okay. Very good.
Nothing else.
Tell us your average schedule. Like, what time did you wake up this morning? What time do you go to bed on average?
Yep. I have a student schedule, mind you, so I have flexible hours. I don't go into an office every day, but I still wake up and I'm active at 8 a.m. and then usually I'm in bed by midnight.
Nice. Good stuff. Are you a morning person or a nighttime person?
I'm a nighttime person, but I try to be a morning person.
All right. Do you like cats or dogs? What do you like better?
Dogs.
Are you more like a dog or more like a cat?
Oh, I think I'm actually more like a cat. Curious, inquisitive.
Good stuff. All right. Now, let's wrap this up. Thank you for being such a champion here in the lightning round. You totally officially won, and you will get the key. We're giving away a Porsche. I just don't know where the keys are. So when we find the keys, I'll give you a call and let you know where you pick the Porsche up, okay?
Excellent. I'll fly anywhere JetBlue flies. I can pick it up.
There you go. Exactly. All right. In closing, let's go ahead. And I want to think about the 20-year-old Paul Brown and the Paul Brown of today. What would the Paul Brown of today want to tell the 20-year-old version of yourself? What advice would you give?
Trust yourself. It will work out okay. Mm. I think, you know, I was an honor student in high school and college, and I get that mentality, and I've worked with a lot of honor students, and those people, myself included, tend to put a lot of pressure on themselves and feel like there's maybe one path that's the perfect path. And sometimes, you know, the enemy of the good, perfect is the enemy of the good. So that gets in their way, and they think it always has to follow a certain method. And so I'd say, don't worry about following a certain path or feeling like it has to flow in a certain way. Lean into some discomfort and go with it.
Awesome. Well, what a great way to end the show, and thank you for your time today. So that listeners can learn more about you, Paul, you're everywhere, but what's the easiest way, and what's the way you want people to reach up and follow up with you?
Sure thing. So I have a very common name, Paul Brown. So I go by my full name, which is Paul Gordon Brown, when I'm online. So if you attach that to pretty much anything social media, you will get me. Facebook.com/, that's my Instagram name, that's my Twitter handle, that's my website, paulgordonbrown.com. So any of those means I am very, you know, comfortable with people reaching out to me. Email, I use Gmail. So paulgordonbrown@gmail, however you want to do it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Paul, for being a guest on the Collegiate Empowerment Show. On behalf of the listeners, it was a real joy. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom, all the insights, and we look forward to having you back on a future show.
Great. Thanks, Tony.
You got it. Be well. Well, there you have it, another wrap of another episode of another interview with somebody in higher education who's not just sitting back passively, but they're being a creator of the bigger future in American higher education. With that being said, let this interview with Paul Gordon Brown serve as an inspiration for you to get out there from just doing your good work to do your great work, ultimately to do your God's work, just like Paul is. In the meantime, be well, and as always, follow your vision. Thanks for listening to the Collegiate Empowerment Show.